the middle of our study of the wisdom literature, and we've been looking at the book of Proverbs, and we've seen that the book of Proverbs is designed specifically to give one wisdom, to make one wise, and we had started looking at the first couple of chapters of it, and looking at the fact is that to become wise takes study, it takes effort. Proverbs tells us very specifically that wisdom is like buried treasure. It's like silver. You have to search for it. You have to work for it. It doesn't just come by osmosis. Okay? We've also discussed the fact that Proverbs is a very interesting book in that it is not formatted or laid out like most of the other books of the Bible. Almost every other book, you can outline it, break it up into parts. For example, even the Gospels, even though we know the Gospels are not for the most part chronological, there is a logical order to them. Like Matthew, for example, Matthew is broken up into and centers around five discourses of Jesus. All right, and the purpose in the laying out of the book of Matthew is to present Jesus as the Messiah to the Jews. And that's why the book is laid out in the manner that it is. As opposed to Luke, which is a very chronological, gospel. Okay? And again, with the purpose of it laid out. Proverbs, we know the purpose. It's laid out right in the beginning. It's to give one wisdom, to make one wise, to make the naive prudent, to help us to understand riddles, to understand the saying of the wise. We see all of that right in the very beginning. And therefore, it is laid out very differently and very difficult to organize. In fact, I thought I might show you what I did. When I preached through Proverbs, and I told you it's a very difficult book to preach through systematically. It's very easy to take out one verse or even a couple of verses and preach from Proverbs, but to preach through Proverbs systematically is very difficult. And what I wound up doing, you can see I used this extensively. This was the cover that I had made up. And what I did was I organized all of the sermons I did. I did a total of, let's see, it was 104 messages from Proverbs. And I titled each one, and I put down the date, and then the main text that I used. All right? So that's how I laid this out when I was preaching through. Now, I've never done this with any other book that I preached through. All right? And the reason is every other book was very easy just to lay it out systematically. Proverbs is not. So what I did was I copied... Let me put some of this down here. All right. I copied the book of Proverbs from the computer and pasted it onto my Word document. And then if you can see, for each verse, I have under it the messages that I referred to it. So that I can go to this and I can... If I look up a verse of Proverbs, it will immediately, like for example, like this one, Proverbs 1:6, to understand a proverb and a figure. No, wait, that's the wrong one. 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I use that 12 times when I preach through Proverbs. And so that's the way I organize this. It's not systematic per se. But it's at least so I can go through the entire book of Proverbs from my notebook, and I can see how many times I utilize it and what context that the verse came up in. All right? That's extensive. All right? And I did that so that the reason I did it was not even so much for my own personal use, but so that I was making sure that I was doing justice to the text when I preached through it. I wanted to make sure that I covered every verse in the book of Proverbs. So you can see it's very difficult. And that's exactly what Proverbs tells us. Proverbs tells us that if you are one who wants to gain wisdom, you've got to work for it. You don't find wisdom just laying around. Just like you don't find silver and gold and precious gems laying around on the street. You have to search for it. You have to dig for them. It's like hidden treasure. All right. So I would suggest that everyone does some work on a regular basis in Proverbs. I'm not saying that you have to start from the beginning or right through the very end. But there's some good commentaries on Proverbs. We have teaching series on it. Unfortunately, most of these, I think, are on tape, but we'll see if we can get them. Well, Lord, I think John said he might have actually transposed them into digital now. So we're trying to get all of our messages into digital form. Again, why do we want to do this? Because Proverbs deals with all the issues of life. Okay? Remember, we also had mentioned that Proverbs is like a commentary on the law. We know how we're supposed to live. How do we apply that to our daily life? Proverbs is what tells us that. Now, I wanted to say one other thing before we continue along and look at some of the specific areas of Proverbs. Is Proverbs is given in a format in which it is like more like advice or telling of circumstances and the consequences of actions more than it is giving direct commands. The law commands, thou shalt not or thou shalt, all right? When we have an imperative from the Scriptures, we have no choice but to obey what that command says. Proverbs is not written like that. So, I mean, there are cases in it that where it is. But for the most case, Proverbs is giving us consequences or telling us this is the best advice when you come across circumstances. And you have to take it and apply it to your life. And let me give you a perfect example of that. Turn to Proverbs chapter 26 so that you can see what I mean. Proverbs 26, verses 4 and 5. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will also be like him. Now, it would be wrong to take that. That's a command. I must never answer a fool. See, this is the point that I'm trying to make. Because what's the very next verse? Answer a fool. Why? And why is it that sometimes answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he may not be wise in his own eyes? So notice, you have two commands, so to speak, if you take them as commands, that apparently are contradictory. But they're not. What Proverbs is telling, there is a time that when a fool is speaking, leave him alone. Because if you engage in his rhetoric, you're going to look just as foolish as he is. So avoid that. There's other times you need to answer that fool, otherwise he's going to appear wise to people. Now, how do you know the difference? Get wisdom. You see the point? And that's why we need to be careful when we handle the Proverbs of taking things and making them an absolute. I'll give you another example. One of the admonitions of Proverbs is don't be a surety. You know what a surety is? That means co-signing a loan, so to speak. Don't co-sign loans. But then it gives the reasons. Because you may wind up having to pay the debt. All right? So is that a blanket command? Is it a sin for a Christian to co-sign a loan just as it would be a sin to break one of the Ten Commandments? No. No. What Proverbs is saying is, if you're going to be a surety, you better know what you're doing. And in fact, if you go through the rest of Proverbs, you find out if you're going to co-sign a loan for somebody, you better be prepared to pay that debt because you have to assume that that person may. What happens if that person can't pay? You signed on it, and you can't get mad at him. All right? So that's why, in most cases, the advice is don't be co-signing loans. Certainly don't co-sign them frivolously, all right? And then there's a lot of other things concerning debt and everything else as well. Proverbs deals a lot with that, but it's more in giving advice and teaching you how to be wise and how to do this. For example, Proverbs also tells us, that the debtor is a slave to the one who's lending the money. All right. So what's the general thing? If at all possible, don't become a debtor. But if you do, there are also principles in Proverbs telling you how to get out of debt quickly, what debt you should take on, what debt you shouldn't take on. You see, so it's not the black and white issues of the law, but it's because living is not black and white issues. You have a lot of discretion. That's the purpose of Proverbs. Proverbs is that if you're going to live life, you want to live it as wisely as possible. And here's the advice that you're going to get. That's why Proverbs is so important, as is all of the wisdom literature. All right. And so often I've seen people just completely misuse the book of Proverbs because they try to make black and white commands out of it. And in fact, sometimes in Proverbs just tells you this is the way it is. You know, you say, why is that verse in there? Well, it's just kind of telling you this is what life is like. Get over it. You know, and get used to it. Because guess what? In this world, life is not fair. In God's kingdom, everything is perfectly just. Everything will be, everything will work out in the end. But during this life, guess what? You may be treated unfairly. You may be treated unjustly. How do you handle that? Because in this world, most of us don't have the ability to see that we get perfect justice. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that? Proverbs tells you how to deal with that. In many cases, just says, learn to live with it. Why? Because in the end, there's perfect justice in God's world. And sometimes, and Jesus picks up on this theme to his disciples. Also, you will find the teaching of Jesus is a perfect parallel to the book of Proverbs. Even though he very seldom quoted the book, but yet the principles he taught are all principles that we've already learned in Proverbs. All right? And Jesus tells us that, you know, that you may be treated unfairly in this life. In fact, not may, if you're a Christian, you will be treated unfairly. You're not going to get justice in this world. And what does he say? Don't worry about it. Why? Because you've given up nothing in this world that you're not going to get back fourfold. Right? So that's why, see, that's another reason that Proverbs is so important. Let's look at some of the things that Proverbs deals with. All right? In Proverbs 3, 27 to 30, I preached a message and it says, Proverbs makes good neighbors. Proverbs teaches you how to be a good neighbor. How are you supposed to treat people that you come in contact with? Proverbs deals with that. Proverbs deals with debt, the whole idea of debt. Proverbs deals with laziness. What are the consequences of laziness? Okay. How do you identify a lazy person? Okay. Proverbs deals with all of that. Proverbs deals with money in many different ways. How do you handle money? How should you handle money? How to make money honestly? What do you do with all those type of things? It deals with self-deception. Proverbs deals extensively with how to use your mouth. Tells you what to do with your mouth. How to speak to people. All right. And there's just so many verses that have to do with that. Proverbs also has an admonition on how society should be structured. In fact, I preached one message from Proverbs, and at the end of the message, I addressed it to all the members of our government. And actually a couple people in the congregation had tapes made, this is back when we were still using cassette tapes, and sent it to all of our local governing officials. I don't know if they ever listened to it or not, but the whole end of the message was geared towards our governing officials, telling them, this is what you must be doing, this is, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Because the Bible is not silent about politics, about what rulers should be doing, about how they should be treating the people that they are serving. And in fact, even that point, they are not our leaders. They are more our servants. All right. They are to be servant leaders. And so we need to understand that. So if you really want to look at what does a godly society look like, come to Proverbs. And Proverbs tells us. Of course, it deals a lot with the mouth, et cetera. Oh, it deals with the criminal justice system. How should we be treating our criminal justice, our criminals, and et cetera? It deals with alcohol. How do you use alcohol? Is it proper to drink alcohol? There's a lot of it, and a lot of it is in there on the whole idea. In fact, it was interesting because the one message that I preached, it just so happens. Don't you love it when things just happen that way? Coincidence. It came up on just before Christmas, and so I titled the message "Holiday Cheer," because you know if you ever work in an office building right around Christmas, everybody's always, "How would you like some holiday cheer?" You know. So I preached a message on that. What is the Christian's view on alcohol? You know, what should it be and what shouldn't it be? And of course, we've taken a stance in this church. The Bible deals with real alcoholic beverages. Wine in the scriptures is wine. If you drink too much of it, you're going to get drunk. And the Bible, of course, forbids drunkenness under any circumstances. All right? But it never forbids outright, you know, the taking of a glass of wine. So, but we deal with that. But drunkenness is always forbidden. Okay? It deals with the idea of, in fact, for women, how do you clean your house? Cleanliness. Proverbs deals with that. Proverbs also takes the whole concept of sin and talks about just how sinful sin is. I know that sounds funny, doesn't it? But it deals with the sinfulness of sin, because far too often people consider sin very trivial. And Proverbs tells you the consequences of living a sinful lifestyle and what you can expect. Some of the other things, wisdom for rulers, we've talked about that, tells you the difference between zeal and envy. Okay? There's a whole section in there on that. It also talks about useless religion. There are people out there who are, quote, very, very religious, and yet it's absolutely useless. Okay? And by the way, we don't shy away from the term religion. Okay? There's a lot of people that shy away. Oh, no, we're not a religion. Christianity's a religion. And there's nothing wrong with the use of it, with the use of the word. But we want to make sure that we use the term right. There is a useless religion, and then there is the one, the true religion, you know, which is, of course, Christianity. All right. Proverbs deals with self-control. It deals with the idea of bribery versus gifts. You know, and this is something that we see in our government, which is a big problem. You know, what is bribery versus, you know, giving somebody a gift? Proverbs deals with that. It has to do with family matters. Of course, we see a lot about family matters. Husbands and wives, fathers and children, mothers and children, and then even how to deal with our extended relatives, if you want to get a good view on that. Now, notice how many of these topics I'm dealing with. This is why I'm not dealing individually with these in this class, because this is a survey. And it took me 2 years to preach through Proverbs. And so we're just giving you a little overview, a little survey now. And I'm hoping that we're wetting your whistle a little bit so that you will look into this great book, because it's a book that every Christian should be absolutely familiar with. And I would even take time, you know, if you go through it, to make up something like this, you know, so that you can, you have a handle on it. And so that when you need to know about certain aspects of life, you can find it in the book of Proverbs. All right. It talks about repentance, talks about fear. Proverbs talks a lot about fear. What is a godly fear? What is an ungodly fear? It talks about principles of work, principles of success. You want to know how should a Christian deal with success? And how do you strive for success? Proverbs deals with that. We actually preached a whole message on that. It was called Righteousness, Success, and Faith. And we dealt with that idea. And then, of course, towards the end of the book, we have those two great chapters. They're two of my favorite chapters, Chapter 30 and Chapter 31. Chapter 31, of course, you know, being the excellent wife, and Chapter 30 being the Proverbs of Agur, who gives us some tremendous insight about how to view life. Remember his prayer: two things I ask for before I die, don't make me either wealthy nor poor. You know, and there's just some great wisdom in that about putting balance in the Christian life. All right, and how often have we talked about that lately? Proverbs talks about a biblical balance in life. Don't ask for too much money. Don't ask to be poor. Both have its pitfalls. You know, the extreme poor, what's their tendency? They're going to steal. What's the tendency of the rich? To be proud, say, I don't need anybody else. All right, put me someplace in the middle. Give me just what I need, no more. How many people ask for that? Most of us are just like John D. Rockefeller. Remember, Rockefeller was asked, how much money is enough? Just a little more. Wealthiest man in the world of his time. And that was his goal. But before we start pointing fingers at him, how many of us are exactly the same way? It's just not quite enough yet, Lord. Give me just a little bit more. Okay? So that's pretty much... there's one other. One of the last messages I preached in Proverbs was called Trivial Pursuit, because Proverbs talks about that as well. We can spend so much time pursuing trivial things and neglecting the things that really matter. And again, that's part of wisdom. All right, that's our overview of the book of Proverbs. Any questions, specific questions maybe on the book of Proverbs? It's a tremendous book, and I would heartily encourage you. I would say that of all the books that I've preached to, I've preached to about a dozen books now, which means that, you know, a really deep, in-depth study to preach through a book. I would say that the one I think that was the most beneficial to me was probably the book of Proverbs on a practical level. Not that they all weren't beneficial, but you know what I mean. Yeah, somebody had a raise. Yes, Chris. I had mentioned that last week. I didn't mention it today. But yes, you're absolutely right. Wisdom and folly are moral judgments, not intellectual judgments. Okay? So, and we need to understand that. That's why the fool has said in his heart, that's why the fool is condemned, because it's a moral judgment being made. He has said in his heart, there is no God. Right? And the question is, are we behaving like a fool, or are we behaving like a wise man? All right. And, of course, the epitome of wisdom is wisdom incarnate, is Jesus Christ. Oh, that's something else I should mention. Remember, we've talked about the whole Old Testament looks forward to Christ, right? And that's something that we want to keep in mind. That's one of the main reasons we're doing this survey. The whole book of Proverbs looks forward to Christ, because he is, in him are all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And that's why any education apart from Christ is foolishness. I mean, there's just no way that you can separate that. You know, that's why I'm so strong on a Christian education. When I was at Grace Christian Academy, we advertised our school as classical and Christ-centered. We didn't call it a Christian school. I mean, it was called Grace Christian Academy. But when we advertised, we didn't call it a classical and Christian education. Because quite frankly, the word Christian education has become meaningless in our society. That's why we changed it and called it a Christ-centered education. Because that's what we have to do. Christ needs to be the center. Every aspect of education has to be centered around the person and the work of Jesus Christ. The centerpiece of history is Jesus Christ. If you're teaching history without a view on the cross, you're entering into folly. You cannot make sense or true meaning out of history if you don't have the cross as the centerpiece. Science, unless you understand who God is and His creation, science is absolutely meaningless. And you'll come up with some foolish ideas, such as man came from slime and crawled out. I mean, come on. That can only happen when you take Christ out of it. Mathematics. Mathematics only makes sense when you understand how this world was designed according to fixed laws and principles. And 2 + 2 equals 4 today, yesterday, and will tomorrow, because that's the law. It's a fixed law. All right? Now, who was it who said, ungodly mathematicians can tell you that 1 + 1 = 2. They just can't tell you why. Yeah. That's it. That's the good quote. You say it louder. I know they didn't hear it in the back. Okay. All right, any other questions on Proverbs? We have a few minutes left, and I'm going to start on Ecclesiastes, unless we have other questions on the book of Proverbs. All right, let's go to Ecclesiastes then. Ecclesiastes, and almost everybody is unanimous that this was obviously written by Solomon. There might be some who take a dissenting view, but overwhelmingly everybody recognizes this was written by Solomon, all right, for many, many different reasons. The book is centered on four basic expositions or dissertations from the preacher. Notice how it starts, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And notice what he does. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, one of the reasons that Ecclesiastes, by the way, if you're really becoming depressed, if you're depressed over something, don't read Ecclesiastes. You know, go read some of the Psalms, you know, but no, in fact, I would say this. Anytime you go to read the Ecclesiastes, make sure you understand the book before you start really reading it. Now, is it a valuable book to read? Absolutely. It's indispensable. The wisdom in it is profound, but you have to look at it from the proper perspective to get the benefit out of it. All right? And it's basically, most theologians break it down into four discourses, of Solomon. And they break it down somewhat this way. Well, even before I start to talk about breaking it down, remember who Solomon is and what he did with his life, because that's crucial for understanding the book. Here was Solomon, who prays for wisdom as a young man. God grants him that and then gives him everything else as well. He gives him all the wealth, all the fame, all the power. Remember, during the reign of Solomon was probably the most peaceful period in Israeli history, if not one of the most peaceful periods, one of the most prosperous periods. And the wealth that Solomon accumulated has been disputed by many historians and archaeologists because they say it's just not possible for someone like Solomon in that time period to actually accumulate the wealth that he did. But yet archaeology continues to uncover exactly what the scriptures reveal. Like I think one of them was at Ezion Gabor, is that where he had his stables? And I think was for 1,500 horses and chariots and everything else. He said, that's absurd, you know, in that era to have that many. Well, guess what? They uncovered it. And they found it exactly as the scriptures describe. So we know that, and of course that's even the legends of that he hid his wealth, you know, that the Queen of Sheba gave him. How many people have seen King Solomon's Mines, the movie, and Alan Quatermain? Nobody knows Alan Quatermain? Oh, my goodness. They actually made movies that Richard Chamberlain played Alan Quatermain. No, these guys don't even know who Richard Chamberlain is. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, it's been legendary. They talk about, you know, the quest for King Solomon's Mines, that he hid his wealth and it's somewhere in the heart of Africa, you know, and they've always had these quests like Raiders of the Lost Ark, those type of movies, trying to find the treasures of Solomon. And that's because it was really based upon truth. You know, Solomon had that much wealth. Yet, what did Solomon do? What marked his life? We just went through his life not that long ago. What did he do? What happened to Solomon? What happened to his wisdom? He didn't follow it. He wrote Proverbs. And what kind of life did he live? An ungodly, debauched life. He didn't follow his own wisdom, and he paid the price for it. All right? And so did Israel eventually pay the price for it. God withheld judgment for the sake of David and whatnot, but the kingdom was divided basically because of Solomon. Okay? And that's what we find in the book of Ecclesiastes. And in fact, basically it says this. He says, I have tried everything and nothing is worth anything. Vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. He says, I gave my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all things that are done under the heaven. This sore travail has God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of the spirit. What Solomon did was he took his eyes off God and started seeking happiness and fulfillment from a humanistic standpoint. In fact, I'm going to say this. The book of Ecclesiastes is a commentary on humanism. Think of it that way. It's a commentary on humanism. When you start seeking this life from humanistic terms, you're going to come to the same conclusion that Solomon came to, with the exception of his last conclusion. All right? Because what he does is he searches for everything. He searches for it in riches, in wealth. He looks at everything from being under the sun. In other words, he's looking at it from man's perspective. That's humanism. All right? And so his first dissertation basically covers the first two chapters. All right, where he starts searching for things, and what he sees is futility in everything. The futility of man's knowledge, the futility of pleasure and owning things, the futility of even working hard. He worked hard, he says, and he still saw everything as being futile. The second discourse begins in chapter 3, and that's where he sees that under heaven there is a time appointed for everything. All right? And it's profound what he says. And he recognizes that God sets eternity in the heart of man, but he also recognizes that from a humanistic perspective, none of that works. None of that satisfies. All right. And so his second discourse carries on through to chapter the end of chapter 5. And then the third discourse is from 6 to 8, chapter 6, 7, and 8. And the central theme there is that there's no satisfaction in earthly goods. You can accumulate everything you want. All right. And then the last discourse, which goes right to the end of the book, is that there is no justice. Basically, there is no justice in the world. And so he's looking at everything that he has worked for in his life and throws up his hands and basically says, there's nothing. But he comes to the end of the book and he sees, and again, notice what he says, verse 8 of chapter 12, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. There's your commentary on humanism. But now look at the last few verses. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. The words of the wise are like goads, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. All right? Beyond this, my son, be warned. The writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments. Because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. There's the bottom line. If you are looking at things from a purely humanistic perspective, if you do not look at Christ, then vanity of vanity, all is vanity. Go ahead. Vapor. Yep. Yes. Absolutely. And in fact, you need to understand that even to understand taking the Lord's name in vain. There's an emptiness. See, we think of vanity as prideful, which it is. But it also has the whole connotation of vanity is an emptiness, just like a vapor. It's nothing. It's there and it's gone. Like our life, what is James says, our life is like a vapor. We're here today, we're gone. All right? And that's what he's saying. Vanity of vanity, all is vanity. That's why I say I just think that this book, Ecclesiastes, is a commentary on humanism. The last part is the redemption of the book. That's where he goes, not the redemption of the book, the redemption of Solomon. Because he recognizes, apart from the fear of God, what is there? Vanity. There's nothing. It's emptiness. And isn't that the biggest problem? Do you know one of the largest enterprises, the largest, where more sums of money are spent than almost anything, any place else, in our society? Psychology. Who's in therapy? Almost everybody. All right? The therapists are in therapy. And in fact, if you go to a Freudian psychologist, he says they need a psychologist. The psychologists need psychologists, so they counsel each other. It's all vanity. Why are we spending billions of dollars on entertainment, seeking fulfillment? Why, you know, and the entertainment industry, records, plays, et cetera, et cetera. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there's anything specifically wrong about these things. We should be enjoying them. But why the record amount of time and money? Why are movie stars and athletes making hundreds of millions of dollars? Because people are looking for fulfillment and are willing to pay. Does it fulfill? No. Especially if you're a Mets fan. Talk about vanity of vanities. Okay. All right. So that's, again, that's just a very quick overview of the book of Ecclesiastes, but again, a very, very worthwhile book. And one of the biggest benefits of Ecclesiastes is understanding who wrote it, where he sunk to, even with all the wisdom that God had given him. And that's a caution to us. Don't ever get puffed up. Don't ever think, well, yeah, I got it. No, we need to be very, very careful that because God has saved us. And that's why, and I think that's one of the most helpful things of understanding the doctrines of grace. If you really understand the doctrines of grace, God saved you, having done nothing to earn it, to merit it in any way, that's got to keep you humble. No such thing as a proud Calvinist. That's an oxymoron. Can't be. If you're prideful, you can't be a Calvinist. And if you're a true Calvin, you can't be prideful. Because you understand, I've done nothing. I deserve nothing. In fact, I deserve less than nothing. Remember, what is man when he's put on the scales? The scales go up. We're less than nothing. We're like a vacuum. Okay? All right, let's pray. Father, once again, we thank you for your word, the wisdom that you've given to us in it. Bless it now, Father, to us as we prepare to worship you. Help us to worship you in spirit and in truth this morning. May it be pleasing to you and give glory to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.